am delighted and deeply honored to have been chosen to give the dual lecture for this 2016 American Philosophical Association Central Division meetings. My understanding of the format is that one seeks to combine personal reflections on one's life and career with thoughts on the development of the profession over the period, in keeping with the Dewean vision of philosophical enterprise that is self-consciously part of society rather than conceiving of itself as lifted above. So the aim is an intellectual autobiography that is linked to a personal autobiography. I'm happy to offer such an overview and retrospective, and those members of the audience who have heard or read some of this before will forgive the repetition. So as those of you who have read some of my stuff know, I'm a sucker for cute titles. So I was trying to think of one for this talk, and I came up with two candidates, both of them unfortunately unsatisfactory in different ways. One was it might seem Eurocentric, the other was it might seem offensive. So I'll start with the Eurocentric one and then get to the other one later. So my first title is The Red and the Black. So with apologies to Stendhal, and their talk has nothing whatsoever to do with the book apart from the title. My title, that title, is meant to indicate both two central theoretical reference points for my philosophical work, Marxism and the diaspora black radical tradition, and in addition, the shift in racial slash color identity I experienced in moving from a native Jamaica to the United States. I was born in England of Jamaican parents, who had gone to the mother country to get an education, a familiar part of the colonial tradition. However, they returned to Jamaica the same year of my birth. So I grew up and went to high school and university in Jamaica, where I did an undergraduate degree, not in the humanities, but in physics. This was not, believe me, a free choice, with the consequence of several humanities teachers having left my high school the year I entered sixth form, the British systems might work, thereby limiting options for specialization at A levels. So with maths, physics, and chemistry as my subjects, I then had a truncated range of possibilities at the University of the West Indies. Making the best of it, I chose physics. Having graduated, I taught for a while at a community college, but decided that unless I wanted to be locked in permanently into this undesired future career, I should sooner rather than later jump disciplines and try to be trained in a different field. Why philosophy though? Here I have to sketch for you a quick picture of the ferment of Jamaica in the 1970s. Which is roughly the equivalent of the 1960s in the United States, and a naive young man's conception of what philosophy was supposed to be capable of doing. But that requires a brief history lesson, so indulge me. Jamaica was invaded by the Spanish in 1494, discovered, we're taught in high school, but as you're aware, vocabularies have somewhat shifted since then, as part of the Colombian borders of conquest in what was for them the New World. The indigenous Amerindian population, the Taino people, were completely wiped out and replaced by captured African labor for the slave plantations the Spanish installed. This was, of course, the norm for the region. The Caribbean is one of the earliest colonized parts of the world, with Spanish, French, British, and Dutch all fighting over the spoils and different countries changing from one set of imperial hands to another. The Spanish were driven out by the British in 1655, and Jamaica became a British colonial possession for the next 300 years, not gaining its independence until 1962. But under British rule, it continued to be what it had been under the Spanish, i.e. a slave society, dedicated to the growing of sugar cane for the production of molasses, from which sugar was crystallized for the European market. Thus was born the famous triangular trade. Ships would leave Britain from ports like Bristol and Liverpool, bound for West Africa, carried manufactured goods, copper, cotton, to exchange for slaves. They would then head westward to the Caribbean with their slave cargo, and then they would then return on the final leg or side of the triangle to its European apex, carrying brown sugar or molasses to be made into rum and refined white sugar. One does not have to be a Marxist to see the overwhelming shaping of this process, the dynamic of national development at both the privileged and the less privileged poles by economic forces. And likewise, of course, the social structure of Jamaica. Given the extinction of the indigenous population, the new population was overwhelmingly African, with a small white planter class and a few people of mixed racial origins serving intermediate social groups. At the high point of slavery, which was not abolished until 1834, the black slave population outnumbered the free white population by a ratio of about 20 to 1. After emancipation, keeping with the pattern in other Caribbean territories, it was the slave owners who were compensated for the loss of their property, not the slaves. Unsurprisingly then, in the absence of any attempt to give reparations, blacks would remain at the bottom of the Jamaican social hierarchy for the next century plus. The social structure, in the assessment of a famous Jamaican anthropologist of the time, M.G. Smith, who taught at Yale, could be thought of as a color-coded pyramid. Blacks, the vast majority, at the bottom, workers and peasantry, browns, a small mixed intermediate race right in the middle, and a small white elite at the top. Where in the United States, blackness is determined by the one property pool, by which any black ancestry makes you black, in Jamaica and most of the Latin nations, racial mixtures are recognized as a separate category, or I should say separate categories. Browns, though subordinated with respect to whites, or socially privileged with respect to blacks, and as independence approached in 1962, would increasingly share in the running of the country. So though in terms of demography, Jamaica was an overwhelmingly black nation, it was not the case at the time that blacks had real political power or equal economic access. As late as the 1970s, for example, a sociological study showed that the Congo was dominated by 21 families, none of whom were of African origin. So why, as you have doubtless been wondering for some time and shifting your seats accordingly, why have I been going into all this boring historical and sociological stuff, and what on earth does it have to do with philosophy and what is supposed to be due election? Well, I would claim that actually, since my area of specialization is social and political philosophy, it has everything to do with philosophy. And I don't just mean what might seem uncontroversial, Jamaican or Caribbean philosophy, speaking as someone from the former third world. No, I mean what would probably seem far more controversial, that whether you Americans want to recognize it or not, I'm speaking for you also, that Jamaica is a creation of the West, that is part of the West, that the West has made us, and we have helped to make you. That we, tiny Jamaica and the huge United States, are both former slave societies, that race and racial subordination has been central to both our histories and also the legacy from these histories, that though it is harder to avoid this reality in a black majority society such as my own, it is no less true for you that under these circumstances, to frame society as being, and I hear a famous quote from John Rawls, a cooperative venture for mutual advantage, as Rawls recommends we do, is absurd. That far from it being possible to consider society as, another quote from Rawls, a closed system isolated from other societies, these transoceanic intercontinental relations of extraction and exploitation have from modernity onwards, if not long before, shaped all the parties involved from the start. And the unavoidable implication, no matter how successfully it has been avoided, by a West that now wants to disavow its own past, is that corrective justice in general, and racial justice in particular, needs to be at the center of any serious theory of social justice. And that perhaps understandably, the perspective of those who are dropped off on the second leg, remember, of the triangle coming from West Africa to Jamaica and the other Americas, and the perspective of those who land at Plymouth Rock, or later at Ellis Island, the social and political experience of these folks is likely to be radically different, and the philosophy, accordingly, is also likely to be radically different. But to a certain extent, I've got ahead of myself. So let me return to the Jamaica of the 1970s, a decade after independence from Britain. Far from the deep problems inherited from 300 plus years of colonialism having been solved, unemployment, poverty, racial division, police brutality, they had in many cases worsened. So that had the opposition party, the People's National Party, not swept into office in a landslide victory in 1972, some feared that social revolution might actually have broken out. And remember, this is only a decade plus after the Cuban revolution. The PNP was nominally a social democratic party, with links to the British Labour Party and the tradition of England of Fabian socialism. But in the 1950s, under the pressures of McCarthyism and Cold War, they had moved right. So their program had become not that much different from the Jamaica Labour Party. But one of those histories too complicated to recount here, exactly the Conservative Right-wing Party. But now, under the leadership of Michael Manley, the PNP moved back to the left, formally announced her platform of democratic socialism in 1974. Even in first world countries, such changes in direction aroused alarm and opposition in the privileged classes. In a third world context, the sense of entitlement is far greater, especially when class largely overlaps with race, and the reaction correspondingly far more hostile. The result in the 70s was years of intense political debate, political struggle, political turmoil throughout the country as a whole, fanned not merely by the local conservative newspaper, but by foreign press worried about Jamaica's becoming, quote-unquote, another Cuba. And for those of you who follow World of Fiction, the Booker Prize was recently won by a Jamaican novelist, Marlon James, in a book that appeared briefly in the New York Times bestseller list, and it deals in part with this history. And then accordingly, in line with this social turmoil, you had a range of radical ideologies being reborn after, you know, the decade of the 50s, and its suppression along with that. So Marxism, both in independent versions and in party-linked Marxist-Leninist forms, different varieties of black nationalism demanding black power, a slogan taken over from the American movement, but still very relevant in the Jamaican context, given the exclusions I've described, a newly respected Rastafari consciousness, buoyed by the growing international success of Bob Marley, and attracting middle-class converts, and debates at the University of the West Indies on dependency theory, the plantation school as a model for understanding Caribbean economies, Cuban Revolution, and the enduring manifestations of race and color privilege in country. So it's in the milieu of this intense period of challenge, the inherited social order, that me, that myself, born engaged doing teaching natural science, I began to think that philosophy, this ability to grasp the big picture, might be the appropriate discipline to provide an overarching and illuminating insight into these matters. I had never done a philosophy course during my undergraduate degree, so it was largely a leap in the dark. But with the help of a Commonwealth Fellowship, again that old colonial connection, I embarked on a master's at the University of Toronto. And here I'd like to register a note of appreciation to the Russell Scholar. Someone that, you know, if any of you folks work there, you might know, John Slater, was on the admissions committee, and who, as he told me many years later at my graduation, overrode the skepticism of the other committee members, understandable enough, given my almost complete lack of background on the subject, and insisted that I be given a chance and admitted. So I returned home after the master's, still not sure this is what I wanted to do. But through a combination of factors, the intensifying debate in the country renewing my interest, and no less potent a factor, the hellish experience of teaching bratty 30-year-olds at one of the local high schools, who had immediately divined my complete wimpish inability to enforce any kind of discipline, and decided anything had to be better than this, so I returned to the University of Toronto to embark on a PhD. So then, as now, the University of Toronto had the largest philosophy department in North America. In my time, with about 65 professors and 130 graduate students. But if the disciplinary whiteness in the US, even today, is extreme, imagine what it was like back then in Canada. The smaller national minority population to begin with, no black studies department at the university, and if I recall rightly, a grand total of 4 black faculty in the entire university, none in philosophy, of course. For some time, I was in fact the only black student in the program. He was eventually joined by a Nigerian, Olufemi Taiwo, with whom I've remained friends all these years, and was currently at Cornell, though not in philosophy in African studies. At the first meeting I attended of the Canadian Philosophical Association, I seemed to be, so far as I could tell, the only person of color in the entire meeting, whether faculty or student. When I graduated years later, I thought I might have been the very first black PhD from the program. But again, Slater told me that I had a predecessor. And indeed, Leonard Harris's pioneering collection of African-American philosophy has a list at the back of, you know, black philosophers, and it says that one, Mark Morland, had done his doctorate at U of T way back in 1937. Currently, Chika Jeffers, black Canadian, A Northwestern student recently tenured at Dalhousie University is fulfilling the role of, as I told him, your mission, if you accept it, is all black man in Canada, and doing an excellent job of it. I'm proud to say that I had a role in directing his dissertation at Northwestern and will cheerfully take as much undeserved credit as I can for his success. So I was being introduced to the whiteness of the profession, an ongoing problem all these decades later. Coming from that kind of world in Jamaica that I described to you, and then encountering the work of John Rawls, where you know, all these instances seem to be absent, I decided that whatever political philosophy was, this was not a subject that I could do stuff I was interested in doing. So I decided instead to do Marxism, which was not that helpful in the issues of race and imperialism, which I was interested in, but did at least seem to recognize the importance of understanding social oppression. So I hung out on campus with the white left in philosophy and political science, while also being active in the African Caribbean Students Association. And I supplemented my readings in Marxist philosophy with extensive readings from outside sources. Radical geography, third world studies, African-American texts, and so forth. I must admit that the feminist theory came a long time later. So as I said, black and red. Not having a first degree in philosophy may have been a handicap in forcing me to spend a lot of time doing catch-up. But in retrospect, I think it had the advantage that it meant I was coming to philosophy from the outside, and thus finding strange and problematic some of its framings in political philosophy in particular. In a way that might have been harder if I had been deficiently socialized in disciplinary norms from the start, I began to think that there was something kind of weird about this way of doing things, and I'm delighted to hear Jason all these years later saying, yes, Charles, you're absolutely right. Interdisciplinarity came naturally to me from the start, both because I was in my own graduate work entering a different discipline from my undergrad degree, and because to find discussions of race and imperialism, I had to go outside the profession. So I decided to do my dissertation, as Jason says, on the concept of ideology in Marx and Engels. In those distant pre-postmodernist times when dinosaurs walked the earth, ideology seemed to provide the most theoretically powerful framework for linking social ideation with social oppression. So it was a natural choice that I assumed would later be applied to other issues than the class-based ones on which Orthodox Marxism focused, the issues of race and imperialism that I was seeking answers for. I worked with the department's two Marxists, Frank Cunningham and Danny Goldstein. So I was reading to recite a long list of names, explicitly not to conjure within these times. I was reading Marx, Engels, Plekhanov, Lenin, Gramsci, Althusser, Poulantzas, Stuart Hall, and so forth. Except Hall himself, that's still a name to conjure with, fellow Jamaican based in Britain since the 50s, by the way, who would become world famous as one of the founders, or maybe the founder of cultural studies, and whose own trajectory moved from Marxism in the 90s toward post-structuralism. So Marxism had been classically seen, of course, as part of the continental tradition. But a series of articles published in Philosophy and Public Affairs in the 1970s on Marx and Justice had shown that, quite contrary to conventional expectations, Marx's claims could be analytically reconstructed and put into fruitful engagement with mainstream liberal discourse, recently revived, of course, by Rawls. The term analytical Marxism would soon be coined to designate work of this kind, and given a huge boost in 1978 by the publication of Jerry Cohen's Karl Marx's Theory of History and Events. It would be difficult to overstate the impact of this book in analytic circles sympathetic to left theory. Remember that though some of the criticism of Marxism from the liberal mainstream of the time had been that was clearly false, another line of critique was that it wasn't clearly anything. It was either so vague and woolly that, in its crucial terms and related pronouncements, that nothing with significant propositional content could be extracted from it, or in Karl Popper's famous judgment in the Open Society and its Enemies, it had built-in hedges that made any eventuality a confirmation. X happened, but what do you expect, comrade? A natural move by the bourgeoisie to advance their interests. X did not happen, but what do you expect, comrade? A natural move by the bourgeoisie to concede the later advancement of their interests, and so on. Cohen showed that Marx's claims could, on the contrary, be put in analytical respectable form, that whatever you thought of them, there was now at least a definite there. The version of Marx which chose to defend an old-fashioned Kant, a technologically determined version of Marx, but the point was, I could now probably start thinking of myself as an analytical Marxist. In a few years, Cohen and like-minded colleagues, John Elster, John Grom, and others, established a Cambridge series of books of this genre, a Marxism, at least for its proponents, purge of the Hegelian hocus-pocus and continental blather that so distracted. In keeping with his stern analytic mission to wipe out fuzzy-minded thinking everywhere, but especially Marxism, the leading luminaries of this movement, meeting once a year, self-congratulated, described themselves as the non-bullshit Marxism group. You're not surprised to hear that their adversaries, increasingly convinced that analytical Marxism was taking the hap out of Marxist theory, rechristened them the non-Marxist bullshit group. So I was part of the grad student left, an opposite philosopher more broadly, hanging out on campus and on the Toronto scene more generally, doing solidarity work with Latin American groups and the anti-apartheid movement, and in my case in particular, obviously, also engaged with the large Caribbean population in the city. On occasion, I even found time to do a paragraph or so on my thesis. Toronto is a great city, and even the limited budget of a grad student, there are all kinds of exciting events one could go to. But eventually, alas, good life as a professional graduate student came to an end. I flunked out, i.e. I actually graduated. So now it was time to find a job. While things were sort of not as bad on the market then as they are now, I belatedly recognized that my degree in Marxism was not actually going to be a plus on the market. Somehow no one had informed me this before. Indeed, another of those belated revelations, Marxism was not really an AOS at all. I discovered this from an alarmed perusal of various issues of JFP, still had a copy at the time, of course. Whether I liked it or not, I was in social and political philosophy, which meant that all that other worldly and irrelevant Rawlsian stuff that I turned my nose up at years before was going to have to be mastered. Crash course in reading Rawls post-graduation, at least for teaching, if not research purposes. Indeed, the revelations coming thick and fast. The heyday of left influence in the academy in general, the boomlet produced by people from the radical 60s going into grad school, getting PhDs, and seeking to transform their disciplines by forming radical caucuses, establishing new journals, etc. The heyday of the left was really over. It's just that philosophy, in keeping with the always behind the times, all of Minerva tradition, was getting the news late in the day. Analytical Marxism gave it more respect than Hegelian Marxism, but was still Marxism. And left theory by the mid-80s, with the Reagan and Thatcher revolutions in full bloom, the collapse of Stalinist socialism only a few years away, and the arrival on Atlantic shores of Jacques Derrida and Michel Foucault, was beginning to seem less threatening and subversive, and of course we all want the threatening and subversive, than simply passé and relevant. Apart from anything else, what would class theory really have to say to the increasingly influential women's movement and the long-time struggle of people of color for racial justice? Burned not merely by the internal politics of white male vanguardist organizations, but frustrated also by the theoretical inadequacy of Marxist frameworks, many white women and people of color have been turning elsewhere for radical understandings of the social order. Okay, having spent some time searching unsuccessfully for a Canadian job and good life in Toronto, I realized that I really wanted an academic career I was going to have to leave. Not quite as good a life now with money drying up, and my fellow grads dropping out of the program, or finishing going to law school, etc., etc. I'd have to try for a job in the United States. My first year on the market was half-hearted. I only applied for one job, nominated by the department. The second year said that I had to get seals, so I applied to a dozen of positions. And I got APA Eastern interviews, dated cultural reference once again. I got APA Eastern interviews with Notre Dame, University of New Orleans, Miami, Ohio, and California State College, Bakersfield. As it turned out, one of these interviews resulted in a job offer. And since I was reluctant to spend a third year on the market, my somewhat accidental philosophy career, birthed in naivety and ignorance from the start, I'd have come to an appropriately ignominious end right there and then. But someone on the search committee for the University of Oklahoma, Ed Sankofsky, liking my CV and motivated by diversity considerations, contacted me at the hotel itself. By sheer happenstance, I'd gone up to my hotel room to change. There was this brief window of time before I went back down to the convention, maybe 10 to 15 minutes or so that he called. Maybe he would have tried again, maybe discouraged he wouldn't. But it does bring home how one's life can be changed by seemingly trivial decisions. An extra interview was organized, I did well, and I got a job at the University of Oklahoma, my first job in the United States. In a sense, then, I owe my academic career to Ed Sankowski's determined plugging for a diversity candidate. So having been born in England, grown up in Jamaica, been philosophically educated in Canada, I was now, end of my travels, who knows, in the United States. It was, as you'd expect, an education in many ways. Not the United States, but the South, or maybe depending on how you saw it, in a located Oklahoma Southwestish. A small town, Norman, after all those years in cosmopolitan Toronto. And above all, of course, race. I don't mean my colleagues in the department, of course, were very welcoming, but on campus as a whole, in which there was a grand total of about a dozen black faculty. I was more conscious of race, my race, the race of others, everyday racial dynamics, than I had ever been in my life. Certainly not in Jamaica, not in Canada. It is not that I was ever racially abused or insulted, but that race mediated routine social intercourse in ways that would, of course, be old news to black Americans, this is what they've grown up with after all, which were quite novel to me. Two incidents in particular I recall. In my first month or so at Norman campus, I was being driven around the campus and surrounding parts of town by a black graduate student from another department. I was struck by the large numbers of houses and apartment buildings that had American flags flying outside them, some you would never have seen in Canada. "You guys really love your flag," I commented. "Our flag?" she responded in astonishment. "What do you mean, our flag? That's their flag," beat my tongue. The second episode, I have already recounted in the non-Cartesian Soul, certain words were telling. I was teaching a graduate seminar in Marx, and for a forthcoming section on ideology, decided to prepare a lecture contrasting Marxist and mainstream explanations of racism. So walking into the classroom, I led off with, "Okay, so as you guys know, white racism is the center to this issue. Now there are various explanations given, and they are, stop." I was stopped for a bit. What was I talking about? Racism, a central feature in the United States? Where on earth had I gotten such an idea? So went back and forth over this for the whole class period. My lecture was never given. While the students denied, for example, that blacks had ever been subordinated, that anybody in the US had ever believed in biological determinist views of black inferiority, and so forth. At no stage, I should emphasize, did any of the all-white students display any anger or hostility to me in their response, rather than overriding sentiment as a kind of puzzlement, a sympathetic bewilderment as to where they had gotten such a strange notion from. Perhaps one of them speculated it was because I was a foreigner. So these two episodes wonderfully summarized an introduction to race in the United States. Oblivious white students, or more generally oblivious white people, living as far as blacks were concerned in another country with a different history, in which race, simultaneously disavowed and omnipresent, regulated everyday intercourse and the boundaries of competing realities. Black Americans were, of course, strangers in their own country also, both deeply American and un-American, but my own foreignness was different. Like them, I was an outsider because of race, but my externality was not mediated by belongingness and accustomedness to their bifurcation as theirs was. My outsider status, so to retain the spatial metaphor, was more external, more estranged. Seeing one's life from the outside is always difficult, of course, and perhaps in full detail impossible. The Socratic ideal of self-transparency, admirable as it may be, is ultimately unattainable. But in trying to look objectively at my personal history and ramifications for my philosophical work, I think that while I've both been benefited and disadvantaged in different ways and at different times by my social identity, the overall outcome has been positive. Though, of course, it's presupposed that my philosophical analysis have been found convincing to embrace in question begging to many. Specifically, to invoke standpoint theory, I have been advantaged in a Jamaican context by growing up with social privilege, class, color, and gender, and then I come to the United States as an adult, transitioning to a status of social color slash race disadvantage in that context. I have been epistemically advantaged, not only by the fact of the social subordination, but by its newness, its unaccustomedness to me, one for whom it came as a novel, rather unfamiliar states. Because recall here that, as I said earlier, the US one-drop rule does not apply in Jamaica. In my native country, I'm not black, but brown, or the expression sometimes used, those a light shade of brown, red. A member of the relatively privileged intermediate social group with independence take over the reins of government, even if whites continue to have differential economic power and influence. My parents were both middle-class Jamaicans. My father was a regular member of the Jamaican Civil Service, while doing a master's at Harvard, become a professor at the University of the West Indies, later chair of the Department of Government and dean of the Faculty of Social Sciences. My mother also worked on campus as an executive staff position in the Department of Education. So I grew up in a middle-class home on the campus of the University of the West Indies in a house full of books. I also went to what was then an elite high school, one of the oldest on the island, Jamaica College. I mention all this to emphasize that I was privileged by both my class background and my color, and of course my gender, getting a good education and growing up in a black majority country. It was also the case, of course I didn't recognize until long afterwards, that my own social privilege blinded me to certain realities about the country. Especially since I was living on campus, far away from the British slums of Kingston, the tenement yards in Frenchtown, later made famous by Balmer. So if I have written about white ignorance in my work in reference to the United States, one must not be too self-righteous, because I have in my own time been guilty of a brown ignorance in my own country, as a member of a group categorized by some strains of black nationalists in the 1960s as complicit with the white oppressors. In other words, the oppressors in Jamaica, not just whites, but also browns. So in coming to the United States then, I was to a certain extent changing color, changing race, from brown slash red to black, moving from the status of a privileged brown man to subordinated black man, while retaining the advantage of education and class confidence from growing up in an advantaged social stratum and being in a position to bring them to bear on the puzzle of making sense of a country for whom I was not an equal. In my years of working on my dissertation at the University of Toronto, my original interest in race had been sidelined, but now it began to be revived. The United States, at the end, appreciate, as all black Americans know, was built on race, and any social and political philosopher worthy of its name needed to start from that reality. Moreover, at conference and APA meetings, I was meeting and hanging out with a new crowd, black Americans, and starting to learn from their experience and identify with their struggles. Met people like Lucius Outlaw, Howard McGarry, Lawrence Thomas, Leonard Harris, Bill Lawson, and my fellow Caribbean Bernard Boston. From the beginning, I was welcomed here by black Americans, invited to their social networks, and crucially, educated about the realities of their country and struggled to establish black philosophy, as was then termed. So in effect, as I said, I was making a double transition, both corporal and political, from red to black. If I were asked to choose a particular year to epitomize this shift, it would be 1994. By then, I had relocated to the University of Illinois, Chicago. Richard Trout, then still at UIC, had asked me to join the planning committee for the 1994 Central Division meetings, and I had suggested a market socialism panel, given the ignominious collapse on a few years before of state commanded socialism. Now, in Kansas City, I dropped on the panel to see how it was going. What did I see? Four people on the panel and one in the audience. A clearer indication of lack of interest in this whole subject could hardly be imagined. Well, actually, no, an audience of zero would have been even clearer. On the other hand, the panel I chaired on diversity and ethnic affirmation drew a huge crowd, a manifestation of a growing interest in race. I'm being a message, I thought to myself. In addition, I met for the first time at this 1994 Central meetings two people who had become central players in the field, Louis Gordon and Linda Martin Orloff. Later, in one of the hotel rooms, while Linda and I listened in amusement, Louis, fresh out of grad school at Yale, outlined a plan for black philosophers to take over the world. Might not have noticed anything happening yet, that we've only reached as far as stage three. While I was, of course, appropriately impressed by these ambitions, as also a bit puzzled, since, as you know, in the traditional ethno-racial division of labor global conspiracies, blacks may provide the muscle and the foot soldiers, but the guiding brain power is reserved for Jews. Although when I hesitate to raise these points, Not so much of their objection, more as a question of clarification. Moses explained that he was both black and Jewish. So the conventional separation of tasks stipulated elsewhere was unnecessary. Indeed, it turned out it was not so much asking for our assistance, since he could pretend to do it on his own, as just giving us a heads up. So when this task comes, you'll know when. Seriously, I have the greatest respect for both of them. And unlike me, when decided after my grad school years to confine my activism to the printed page, or as it is kind, they have both gone on to make great organizations as well as philosophical contributions. Linda, as you all know, has been active on numerous APA committees, past chair of SPEP, editor of over 10 books, and authored very influential Visible Identities, and just last year, The Future of Whiteness. I'm delighted to work on her and Frank Kirkland in the human systems coming forward. Lewis has by now authored in less than 8 books, editor of co-edited several more, and was founded in 2005 of the Caribbean Philosophical Association, whose mission it is to shift the geography of reason. So both of them have made major contributions, as against Charles Smith, who has just been watching TV and then writing from time to time. Okay, so we've gone over the water and have let's see, I'm going on to this. How much of this can I inflict on? Inflict. Okay, 1994 was also a crucial transitional year for the following reason. I published articles in that year on Stalinism and the implications of Marx's theory for moral objectivism in continuity with research at the end of my dissertation, but I also published pieces on interracial relationships, the black underclass, distinctive features of African American philosophy, and the need to take white supremacy seriously. A system of domination. So in that respect also was a year of transition, moving from the old paradigm to the new one. And I would not in fact publish another self-conscious Marxist article again until 20 years later, materializing race. So this transition meant a self-conscious immersion of myself in the Black American intellectual tradition, and also the social, scientific, and historical literature on race in the United States. What Black Americans knew from their direct experience was something that I was going to have to read over. But the Caribbean, it should be recalled, has its own major contribution to the international Black radical tradition. Whether in Black nationalism of Jamaican Marcus Garvey, whose greatest success had in fact in the United States rather than his native land, or the Trinidadians, C.L.R. James and George Panmore, both deeply involved at one time or another in international Marxist movements, or Frantz Fanon and Amos Césaire from the French Caribbean. There was, in fact, an entire world of theorists who were completely unacknowledged in mainstream philosophical thought. A Black Atlantic, in Paul Gilroy's famous phrase and conception of thinkers and activists struggling to understand and overcome a system of domination unmentioned and unnamed in the whitewashed world of white political philosophy, white supremacy. So this alternative universe of political philosophies necessarily meant, of course, an alternative picture of the world and its major players. For it would be a mistake to see African American, or more generally Africana philosophy and blackness, in ethnic terms, the equivalent of a meal out on Sunday night at a soul food restaurant, or the purchase of a Navajo rug for the living room on a trip to Arizona, to demonstrate one's multicultural bona fides, culinary and aesthetic. Rather, what is involved for white philosophical audiences is or should be a challenge to the way they have typically understood the world, their place in it, and the nature of their philosophizing involved. It is a matter of redrawing the map of modernity to bring out and make plain the centrality of race and white racial domination to the meaning of the modern world, and the extent to which it has been covered up and obfuscated in standard accounts in our world. In philosophy, at least in the Western tradition, as you know, the aspirations are to be universal and objective, as against the local and particularistic. And traditionally, when the ethnic is marked as non-Western, it is consigned to the latter category. Think of Jean-Paul Sartre's famous categorization of negritude as an anti-racist racism. That's historically completely understandable, but ultimately, as we all know, is a stage to be transcended and sublated universalist dialect. The claim to universal can be substantiated in different ways. So, showing roughly and schematically, I'm going to divide into the ideal and the material. On the one hand, for example, the ascent beyond the world of particularity to the eternal unchanging forms, or to socio-independent, natural liberal rights and freedoms, or the cosmopolitan trajectory of the world spirit. It's the ideal. On the other, more politically informed and socio-historically located epistemic superiority, arising not through abstraction away from the world, but from reconstruction, diving into the depths of the world, or the viewpoint of the socialist subordinate, with the proletariat, the truly universal class, whose emancipation frees everyone by bringing an end to class society, or the woman, whose forced domestic labor brings her into daily and ineluctable contact with the shit and shit work males can escape and evade as creatures naturally of the public sphere. One has to be mindful of the dangers of oppression sweepstakes. Nonetheless, with that sort of caveat in place, I now want to make a case for the black claim to universality and work with locating metaphysically and normatively vis-a-vis these other contenders. And that brings me to my second potential title, which I thought might be offensive. The more black people who might ask for approval, so there are the three black women. Okay, my second title, which I hesitated about. Okay, so warning, N-word coming up. Okay, so my second potential title was Metaphysical Niggers / Nigger Metaphysics. So what do I ask as a reference? Well, like first, this is a literary rather than a philosophical reference. And it goes back to a famous poem by Robert Penn Warren, important American writer of the 20th century. He wrote many books, his best known one being All the King's Men, about the Louisiana demagogue Huey Long, and made it into two films. And this particular quote comes from a poem of his called Upon the Woods. And the voice speaking is the voice of Buzzard. The buzzard says various things, but the key line is, "Nigger, your breed ain't metaphysical." And this line is responded to later by a famous African-American literary critic, a guy called Sterling Brooks, back in the 30s. And his response is, "Cracker, your breed ain't exegetical." It's one of those sort of famous, you know, back and forth in sort of order of letters. So I want to sort of take up this idea, as I say, if you forgive the N-word, metaphysical niggers, nigger metaphysics. And this, of course, on my side, is not use but mention. And what I'm sort of claiming that, you know, what this idea brings out is a black person as metaphysically flat, as metaphysically at zero. So I'll move ahead to another famous guy in France, another zone of non-need. So blackness in modernity, I'm suggesting, Negro, nigger, is not just another ethnic identity, but a racialized identity more systematically excluded from moral equality than virtually any other. So it's not just a matter of oppression, so I'm not claiming that black people have any monopoly on oppression, but the peculiar way this oppression is structured. Whether in theological or scientific racism, in the case of theological racism, you know, going back to the Bible, what is interpreted to be the sort of curse on black people, because in a more curses, you know, they are children of Ham. The idea is curses, your children are always going to be natural slaves. And this then taken up in the Arab world and later translated to the Christian world as an explanation for the fact that blacks are a slave race, and as such, paradigms of curses. In addition, Atlantic slavery, by comparison with other systems of racial domination, like colonialism, not only created a black diaspora to the Americas and Europe, but largely stripped away the original language and customs of the African civilizations from which these people had come. So we sort of mixed people up from different ethnic groups, so that they can't sort of speak language to each other, deracinate them, the idea being we sort of take away their civilizations from them. Jews, of course, have been subordinated, you know, in the West by Christians thousands of years, but Jews were able to hold on to their traditions. So the sort of Jewish identity there, Jewish culture, Jewish religion, Jewish tradition, which is not stripped from Jews in the same way with blacks.
Native peoples in the Americas, similarly, can sort of call on resources of their indigenous identities. People in the colonial world, under, say, French or British rule in Asia, again, have their original identities, original cultures, which they can sort of affirm. But the case of Blacks, people, these which are largely extended, not completely, there are cultural survivors in the West, but a significant extent taken away. So it then means that you have to sort of take race over as an identity in a way that Native Americans, race is not their central identity, they're Sioux, they're Lakota, they're Navajo, that's the identity they're from. These are colonial peoples in Asia, similarly, they can sort of affirm their pre-colonial identities. In the case of Blacks in the New World, within these things largely caught, it's a matter of a self-recreation with race as a category. And the thing about Blackness is, it's not merely the original stigmatization of slavery and being a slave race, but the fact that phenotypically Blacks are so distinct from other peoples, the legacy then stays on your body for hundreds of, well, let's not say hundreds, for 100 plus years going on in the future. So it's not an accident then that the people who have been sort of most active in creating critical race theory, critical philosophy of race, have differential in Blacks. Because for Black people, the New World, the Black diaspora, race then becomes this way of creating identity, given the fact that these African identities are not sort of held to fall back up. So again, want to be careful, don't want to claim that Blacks have a sort of monopoly understanding oppression. But insofar as racial oppression is sort of key feature of the modern world, Blacks are differentially positioned to understand it, given that they are the ones most coordinated by race. And the other linked fact is this. If you look at the different competing ontologies of modernity, if you look at the neoliberal ontology of social contract theory, you look at the competing Marxist ontology that he was for many years as a teacher, you find a situation where in neither of them is this sort of a distinctive feature of racial subordination registered. In the case of social contract theory, the classic debate has been, let's say, Hegelian versus Kantian, is resurrected as communitarian versus contractarian. But on both sides of the debate, it's presupposed that the normative equality of human beings in these societies, whether they consider as atomic individuals who contracted social order, or Hegelian slash Aristotelian, or whatever in their castrated groups, the normative equality of these people is taken for granted. Even Marxism, for 100 plus years, the most important challenger to Western liberal theory, that makes class oppression theoretical central, takes for granted the nature of working class oppression does not lie in the failure of the society to recognize their moral equality, but their failure to admit all structures of class domination undermine that equality in practice. So as Marx famously observes in Capital, you have freedom and equality at the level of relations of exchange that's undercut by the coercion of material inequality at the level of relations of production. So whether in the liberal tradition, sort of mainstream contractarian or Hegelian, or whether the Marxist material tradition, the moral equality of these human beings is taken for granted. So here now is the distinctive contribution you get from racial subordination. And in the version I'm talking about, Black racial subordination. The great insight of the Afro-modern political tradition is that one has the recognition that the system rests on a foundation of denied personhood. It is not merely that Blacks suffer material disadvantages, of course they do, but that their personhood is not recognized in the first place. In the case of the category of Fanon, that's zone of non-being, Frederick Douglass's I'm Not a Man, it's different from white working class subordination, and it's captured in Jean-Paul Sartre's famous preface to Fanon's Wretched of Earth, and I quote, "There's nothing more consistent than a racist humanism across the world. There was a race of less than humans." So it means that the contribution and claiming comes distinctly from Black radical tradition is this recognition of the centrality of this moral inequality in the world, and that the world of persons that we sort of take for granted in standard narratives of modernity, in narratives of the work of liberal theory. This narrative has been severely qualified to recognize that it's only a small subset of the population that recognizes as persons. And that in the case of the black population, you have people categorized as subpersons, and the subpersonhood provides a line of continuity that you can sort of trace back, to, as I say, the curse on Ham's child, to Immanuel Kant, when he declares that blacks are natural slaves, the 25th rule in the American Constitution, trying to sort of work out the extent to which the black slaves count as persons, to the 1857 Red Star decision, where Justice Taney says that blacks have no right that the white man needed to respect, to the I Am a Man demonstrations of the 1950s and 60s, and finally to Black Lives Matter. This line of continuity is expressing the fact that you have a section of human beings originally marked by slavery and then bearing the stigmata of that original categorization still on their bodies. These are people who are not seen as equal persons. So the category of the sub-person I'm suggesting needs to be far more central to our theorizing than it currently has been. So there's a sort of crucial normative dimension of black subordination. But I now want to turn, I think we need to sort of close things off soon. I now want to turn to the sort of second dimension of it, and that dimension is the material aspect of it. There's a growing body of work that makes a case that African slavery has been central to the creation of modern world. The case itself is not new. You can find it in the Black Trinidadian Eric Williams, Capitalism and Slavery, a book that was his dissertation at Oxford, that he was unable to get any British publisher interested in, and he finally had to get it published in the United States. But the contrast by then and now, that was way back in the 1940s, is that this work is now being done by people at the most prestigious universities in the United States. Sven Bekert, Empire of Cotton, Global History, Edward E. Baptiste, The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism, Walter Johnson, River of Dark Dreams, Slavery and the Cotton Kingdom. In all these works, we get a picture that one, capitalism was sort of central to the making of the modern world, which of course, and that's not new, I mean, new mainstream circle, of course, Karl Marx said it a long time ago, but that in addition, African slavery is crucial to the making of capitalism. So, unpaid African slave labor is the material foundation of the modern world. So, put these two together. On the one hand, this category of blacks or persons, metaphysically empty. On the other hand, people whose material labor is the sort of unpaid debt, creation of modernity, and you then get a population whose perspective on social and political philosophy is going to be very different from the mainstream one. Because you're basically saying that there's this unpaid debt hanging over from the past few hundred years, and that your humanity has not been recognized, and there's a sense in which it's not just a matter of accidental ignorance, there are deep stakes in this ignorance. Because we're forced to recognize how completely blacks are excluded, we're forced to recognize how great this debt is, it would then mean that you could no longer go on in the old way. It would then mean that social and political philosophy would have to be done in radically different fashion. And as you'd expect, that's exactly the case I'm making. So I want to wrap up now by talking about the particular line I've been taking in my own work in recent years. And the phrase I've chosen to characterize it is a somewhat weird and oxymoronic one, so you can restrain yourselves from bursting into laughter. Black radical liberalism. What is that? Normally taxonomies of African American thought, it's a clear contrast. There's liberalism, that's mainstream folks, Frederick Douglass, Martin Luther King, Jr., and then there's black radicalism, that's black nationalism, and that's black Marxism. What I'm trying to do is to put them together. Also drawing, of course, on feminist theory, both white and black. And their claim basically is that you can draw different components from these different bodies of thought and come up with a kind of synthesized product, which represents the kind of radical alternative picture of the world, which, once you recognize sort of factual basis that claim has been laid out in these historians' work, and that in drawing on a mainstream normative apparatus from liberal theory, that this liberalism, strange as it should, as might seem, this is a liberalism that should be embraced by white liberals also. Now, in the same way that feminist liberals are, feminist liberalism is not just for women, it's for men, it's all part. The idea is if you're good, male liberal, you should accept this stuff, you should recognize how liberalism is corrupted by patriarchal domination, you should be on our side. And you know, my claim is similar for what I call black radical liberalism. It's not just for black people, white liberals should basically endorse this too. And the argument is that what we need to do is to reject the ascribed ontology of liberal theory, by which I mean an ontology that's either atomic individuals, or even if they're individuals in social relations with one another, as in, say, sort of late 19th century Hegelian liberalism of T.H. Green, or now John Dewey's version, for that matter. We need a liberalism whose ontology is reconstructed to recognize that certain persons are positioned above other persons, and it puts them bottom, the person is not recognized. So you need an ontology of persons and so persons. And if you rethink liberalism on that basis, on this radical new ontology, and of course it's not only the case that some persons are just limited to blacks, but also to colored or generally white women in a more complicated relationship, you would then get a liberalism that's radically transformed. Sorry, 5 minutes more. Yes. There are two books that have had a great impact on me in recent years, both written by white philosophers, one by a well-known white feminist, one by a white mainstream theorist. And Kurtz Analyzing Oppression, I think it's a very important book, both for its content, and because one of the key points that Anne makes at the start is, so far as she knows, this is the first book in the analytic tradition that has taken oppression as its subject matter. Now think of the implications of that. Philosophy, going back to the ancient Greek tradition, we're supposed to be the go-to guys about truth and justice. Other people do justice theory in other kinds of fields, but in that supposed to open up our franchise. And Anne is basically saying that in this 2,000 years history, and insofar as she knows, it was the first that centrally analyzed oppression, which far from being any kind of outlier in history of humanity, past the hunting and gathering stage, or maybe even including it, basically depending on, you know, the gender division of labor, whether it's really equitable or not. Social oppression has been a norm for humanity. So if you're seriously concerned about social justice, how could this not be central to you? And the other book is my former colleague, Samuel Fleischacker, University of Illinois, and Sam's book is A Short History of Distributive Justice. And the short signifies double. The book itself is short, and he's basically saying the actual history of distributive justice is short. And what Sam argues in this book is that what we take to be a long tradition of justice theory, going back to Aristotle and his distinctions, and sort of taken up by Rawls, modern period, and given a sort of distinctively left-liberal twist, this narrative is fundamentally wrong. It's fundamentally wrong because the concept of justice which Aristotle is working is not a concept that extends to everybody. It only extends to those who have a certain status and does not include property. And in Sam Fleischacker's analysis, distributive justice in a contemporary sense, that is a sense of an enormous redistribution of social product applied to all humans, regardless of status, in the modern sense, it goes back only 200 plus years to Babeuf, crucial figure in the conspiracy of equals, was basically tried and had his head cut off under the French Revolution. So distributive justice in the tradition is only slightly more than 200 years old. Now think for a second about the implications of this. If distributive justice applying to everybody is only 200 plus years old, And it doesn't really mean everybody as in everybody, it means everybody as in my mates, even when it's only formulated that way. It then follows that corrective justice for subordinated groups is not part of tradition at all. Because if you're subordinated, and your subordination is not seen as a moral wrong, given that there's no general concept of distributive justice, why would there be any need to theorize corrective justice for the subordinated? So it's not an accident that within the tradition, corrective justice is even less theorized than distributive justice. So put together Ann Codd's book and Samuel Fleischacher's book, and what you get an indictment of Western philosophy as for the most part in complicity with social oppression. And that's really a pretty chastening thought, because it then means that all these books, all these theories over 2,000 plus years, for the most part, they have basically been complicit with existing structures of gender domination, they move into modern period of racial domination. This has not been a problem for them. So I suggest that if you want a philosophy, particularly a political philosophy, that is going to give up its pretensions, a philosophy that's a philosophy above all for those most in need of justice, those most in need of a corrective truth, to sort of make up for the lies that we're told to rationalize their social situation, we need a shift in political philosophy. We need a shift towards non-ideal theory, and we need a shift towards corrective justice. And that one of the tragedies of Rawls's work, I'm not saying he consciously intended it, but the effect of his work has been to make ideal theory, not in the sense of ideal as normative, of course you mean, but ideal theory in the sense of theory of a just society, this has basically given the political philosophy community a pass to ignore all the crucial issues of social justice in our society. We take for granted philosophy that many terms are used as terms of art, they have a different sense, a mainstream sense. If you ask a lay person what social justice means, they're going to tell you it has to be correction of existing justices. And Rawls's work and the work of his disciples has so redefined the term that social justice has become completely detached from the system. And though Rawls himself said in the opening pages of Theory of Justice, the point of doing ideal theory was ultimately a result of move on better good to non-ideal theory, what do we know, 2016? 45 years later, this transition has yet to take place. And even where political philosophers do think of themselves as doing non-ideal theory, it's basically Rawls' principle of distributive justice applied in non-ideal circumstances. And what I'm talking about is what Rawls calls very briefly, I think it's just a two place in the book, compensatory justice. If you blink, you miss it, it goes by so quickly. Compensatory justice, what you would see as corrective justice, the making up for injustice of the past, that should be the focus and sort of the primary concern of political philosophy. So in my own work, which Jason has very generously praised, this is what I've been trying to do. Work within recent years, mainstream liberal tradition, and sort of bring this tradition face to face with its history, and to say, if you are seriously committed to the equality, the flourishing, and the sort of egalitarian norms for all human beings, then you need to sort of face the non-ideal history, bring that non-ideal history into your discourse, and make it your priority. Some people think that our expectations of philosophy are too great, and people are listening to us in the first place. Mm-hmm. But insofar as we do have an audience, we should sort of do whatever we can, sort of make this live up to these pretensions, and try, especially these very dangerous times where there's a possibility of right wing populism, of a population of people sort of worried about in this sort of growing drowning of the United States, Black Lives Matter, particularly in these times. We want a philosophy that can give up the best traditions of the subject and have a situation where equality, liberty, and justice are realized for all. Thank you.